Welcome to the Thomistic Institute podcast. Our mission is to promote the Catholic intellectual tradition in the university, the church, and the wider public square. The lectures on this podcast are organized by university students at Thomistic Institute chapters around the world. To learn more and to attend these events, visit us at ThomisticInstitute.org.
So what a splendid time it is to be speaking about St. John Henry Newman, born in 1801, returning home to the Lord in 1890. His life spanned the entire 19th century. He grew up reading the novels of Jane Austen and Walter Scott, for example, as they were first being published. And by the end of his life, the Eiffel Tower had been built, the Papal States had been lost, for good, at least for the moment. Vatican I had concluded with the deeply controversial declaration of papal infallibility. And Europe was just a few short years from the deadly wars of the 20th century. Newman's become, at least for us pursuing the intellectual life within the Catholic tradition, a kind of third millennium standard bearer. His articulation of the development of doctrine profoundly shaped Vatican II and continues to shape the church. His sermons, especially those before his conversion to Catholicism in 1845, make him arguably the greatest preacher of the 19th century. His prayers and poems remain deeply beautiful and widely read. And his final treatise, The Grammar of Assent, is a difficult but immensely thoughtful study of the structure of human thought and belief, continues to inspire those unhappy with the simple dichotomy between Enlightenment rationalism and postmodern relativism. Particularly noteworthy for us gathered here today under the auspices of the Thomistic Institute, Newman was declared a Doctor of the Church just last November and made at the same time the Church's co-patron of education, alongside, of course, St. Thomas Aquinas himself. So Newman's star is on the ascent, as they say, and to be honest, I think it's for very good reasons. Newman's collected works are vast. He was a compulsive writer, living each hour, as it were, with a pen in his hand. Even just his collected letters, well, the ones we've been able to collect, amount to 32 hefty volumes. Just the letters. He wrote two novels, a long poem called The Dream of Gerontius, set to music by the composer Edward Elgar in 1900, hundreds of sermons, long treatises, newspaper columns, and many occasional writings. This evening, I want to consider one corner of Newman's vast literary landscape, his reflections on the university and university life. There's many beautiful things he had to say about those things, as well as some surprising and even to some disturbing things. But first, here's an outline of Newman's life that will help you understand where his writings on education fit into his larger life's work. Newman was born, as I said, in England in 1901, eldest of six children. His parents were members of the Church of England, encouraged their children in the soft beauties of music, art, and theater as they grew up in pretty solid middle-class comfort. At the age of 14, Newman read some of the skeptical books of the Enlightenment. "I recollect," he said once, "thinking I should like to be virtuous, but not religious. There was something in the latter idea I did not like, nor did I see the meaning of loving God." But the next year, at the age of 15, Newman had a great evangelical conversion, a great change of thought. He became convinced of the incarnation of Christ and the gospel ideal of holiness, and committed himself under the influence of what he called a deep imagination to the celibate life. Not long after, he went up to Oxford University as an undergraduate, and having completed his studies, assumed a teaching fellowship at the young age of 21. A few years later, he was ordained an Anglican priest and began the preaching duties that were meant to make him famous. From 1824 until 1845, when he converted to Catholicism, Newman established himself at the center of a movement in Oxford to bring the Anglican Church, in belief as well as in practice, more or less closer to the Roman Catholic. At its height, the Oxford movement, as it was known, found itself on the lips of much of educated English society. It stirred the feelings, both of anger and of appreciation, of a society long used to deep opposition to Rome. In 1845, at the age of 44, Newman finally left the Church of England and joined the Roman Catholic Church, bringing many of his followers with him. It was the most painful break of his life, and though he felt in his soul the necessity, the rightness of the thing, that only sharpened the divisions quickly forming between all he'd known and loved and a very uncertain future. He traveled to Rome to see what might become of him. There he was ordained a Catholic priest and attached himself to the Oratorians of St. Philip Neri. Newman would spend the rest of his life working to establish the Oratorians in England, and his room is still preserved in the Birmingham Oratory. Birmingham, England, I'm afraid. Sorry about that. Where he spent his final days in 1890. He returned to England after his conversion full of enthusiasm in the late 1840s. Enthusiasm for new works in his new church, and he quickly established England's first oratory. Not long after, he was summoned to Ireland to lead the foundation of the first Catholic Irish university. During the preparations for that institution in 1852, he delivered a series of lectures titled collectively, The Idea of a University. During the remaining 1850s, he revised and added to those lectures, publishing them in 1859 and then publishing a revised and expanded edition in 1873. It's the 1873 edition that has come down to us as the official book, The Idea of a University. And its contents are my principal subject this evening. But throughout the 1850s, Newman was preoccupied with education. Besides The Idea of a University, he also published two long essays on Benedictine education, a history of the university as such, and a series of essays on St. Philip Neri and the Oratorian charism. He argued, among other things, that St. Philip's Oratory was a kind of Catholic version of Oxford and Cambridge university life. So the years immediately after his conversion were intense years of reflection on the history, nature, and purpose of education. He left the new Irish university in 1858 and returned to Birmingham. There he settled down, more or less, continued writing, leading his oratorian community, and defending as a public intellectual the church to which he'd devoted the second half of his life. The church finally honored him for that in return, elevating him to the status of cardinal in 1879 under the new leadership of Pope Leo XIII, and now sainthood and doctor of the church in the 21st century. Okay, but now back to 1850s and Newman on education. The idea of a university has had a long and distinguished life that shows no signs yet of abating. It continues to inspire educators across the world, both Catholic and non-Catholic, actually. May I ask, how many of you have read The Idea of a University? Okay, just a couple of you. The rest of you, I'm sorry to spoil it this evening, but you should go back and reread the actual thing as soon as you can. Long before Newman was made co-patron of Catholic education, just last fall, for example, he'd become a foundational intellectual inspiration for the Catholic Studies movement, started in the 1990s. And I hope after the next little while, you'll better appreciate why this naturally became the case. So Newman begins The Idea of a University by assuring his audience he's taking a purely philosophical approach to his topic. I shall consider, he says, the question of the university simply on the grounds of human reason and human wisdom. He meant his words to have force, no matter one's religious commitments. And so he also meant them to be tested against our collective human experience and accumulated human wisdom. The idea of a university is not a work of theology, though it has much to say about theology. It's meant to say something broader than revelation, something that shows how we are the sort of creatures that might be receptive to, even eager for revelation. Now, two problems or challenges lie at the foundation of Newman's lectures. Both are perennial, permanent, as old as human thought itself. First, shouldn't the university make the useful arts and sciences its direct and principal concern? to the neglect of the liberal arts, of course, those studies that fit one for no profession or any profession. You know what I mean. The studies your parents are afraid you'll choose over against business or medicine or law or engineering. We're all familiar with this story, I think. I had a student once, actually, who entered Providence College as a pre-med biology major, and she left as a theology humanities double major. Her parents were reconciled to it by the time she graduated. She's a high school teacher now. But I think they still struggle to embrace it. So first, is a university supposed to be principally a place of usefulness, or instead a place of something else? Second, should the university exclude theology from a place among the sciences? This too is an old question. Mightn't theology be a sort of contaminant for the university, infecting the pure and natural pursuit of learning that is its primary purpose? According to this way of thinking, religious commitment's a matter of taste, emotion, the enthusiasm of one's time and place, rather than a result of intellectual inquiry, resulting in hard-earned truths. Religion, we might think, should be kept out of the university just as it should be kept out of the public square. It's a private matter, shaped by one's private history. It couldn't be, like other university disciplines, a formal science, an object of specialized and focused intellectual inquiry. So, Newman's second question, if a university is where the sciences are studied and taught, do we have reasons for including religion in the essential work of the university itself? Now, Newman begins with this second question in the idea of a university, and he answers boldly, yes. A university worth the name, a university that must as such aspire to the study of all sciences, and so of all things that were and are to be, must also include theology. For theology is fundamentally an intellectual activity, and so lays claim to its own branch of the tree of sciences. That is, there's a fact of the matter, whether or not God exists, what he's like, what he's done and continues to do. As Newman says, religious doctrine is knowledge. It's not mere sentiment or taste or preference. Theology, he says, has at least as good a right to claim a place in the university as astronomy. The study of God's existence and nature and activity is a work of the mind. Both natural theology, philosophical theology, and the theology made possible by revelation. So a university without theology, and by implication an education without theology, is a failed university and a failed education. Why might we think so? Here's a first thought, one of the two deepest thoughts, I think, in the idea of a university. And it's the foundation of what Newman wishes to say about the place of theology. All that exists, says Newman, all that exists as contemplated by the human mind forms one large system or complex fact. And this, of course, resolves itself into an indefinite number of particular facts, which, as being portions of the whole, have countless relations of every kind one towards another. Here's Newman again saying the same thing in a different way. All knowledge forms one whole because its subject matter is one. For the universe in its length and breadth is so intimately knit together that we cannot separate off portion from portion and operation from operation, except by an abstraction. And then again, as to its creator, though he, of course, in his own being is infinitely separate from it, and theology has its departments towards which knowledge has no relations, yet he's so implicated himself within it and taken it into his very bosom by his presence in it, his providence over it, his impressions upon it, and his influence through it, that we cannot truly or fully contemplate the world without in some main aspects contemplating him. That was a long passage, but I think a remarkable one. All knowledge, thinks Newman, forms a whole, a web of interrelated truths that make together a single system, a single unified reality, so that each part has a bearing on each other part, no matter how distant it might at first appear. Each of the so-called sciences is but a partial view or abstraction by means of which we consider one portion, large or small, of the whole. Each individual science is incomplete, needing the assistance of the others and offering its own assistance in return. Suppose one were to say that human beings are as one finds them in biology textbooks with their various systems, the respiratory system, the endocrine system, the nervous system, the cardiovascular system. My 11-year-old is studying biology right now, and she quizzes me at the dinner table on these systems. Sometimes I do well, sometimes not so well. And that was all. We'd rightly reply, no, you've missed important facts about human life. You've said nothing about the emotions, imagination, love and hate, knowledge and ignorance, the interior life, that though surely related to human biology, is not identical to it and can't be safely ignored if we wish to understand ourselves. So too, even more, with respect to theology. We cannot understand ourselves unless we add to our physical life and our mental life a spiritual life, the relations we bear to He who made us and loves us and who sent us forth and calls us one day home again. And therefore, the first thing one must say about theology in the university is this: all knowledge forms one whole, and therefore to know what ought to be known, one must see the relations between things and the place of each in relation to the whole. So religious truth is necessary. But even more than this, it is the most necessary. For some parts of the whole bear more strongly on the rest than others. So much so that for Newman, he says, religious truth is not only a portion, but a condition of general knowledge. To blot it out is nothing short, if I may so speak, of unraveling the web of university teaching. So, omitting theology makes it hard, impossible, to understand fully the objects of all the other sciences. But the omission of theology is a source of another problem. If you drop, says Newman, if you drop any science out of the circle of knowledge, you cannot keep its place vacant for it. That science is forgotten. The other sciences close up, or in other words, they exceed their proper bounds and intrude where they have no right. If the place of theology is left empty, then some other science will assume its role. And here Newman has some very specific intellectual misadventures in mind. He says, without theology, foreign sciences will assume certain principles as true and act upon them, which they neither have authority to lay down themselves, nor appeal to any other higher science to lay them down for them. For example, he says, it's a mere unwanted assumption if the antiquarian says, nothing's ever taken place but is to be found in historical documents. Or if the philosophic historian says, there's nothing in Judaism different from other political institutions. Or if the anatomist says, there's no soul beyond the brain. Or if the political economist, easy circumstances make men virtuous. I think we're all familiar enough with Newman's thought here. Medicine, for example, great as it is, and greatly to be praised, tends to demand of us that we do what needs to be done to extend our life. For medicine is aimed at healthy preservation. But those of you who know the beautiful novel, Hannah Coulter, by the great American novelist, Wendell Berry, how many of you know who Wendell Berry is? A great man. The novel Hannah Coulter by Wendell Berry, you might remember Hannah's husband, Nathan, who after his doctor tells him he has cancer and recommends a series of intense radiation treatments, he stands up, He shakes the doctor's hand. He thanks him for all he's done. And he goes home to die on his own terms and in his own way. So, thus ends Newman's discussion of the first problem, the place of theology in a university. Theology, the study of the divine life and its relations to all that is necessary in its own right. For it too is a branch of knowledge, and since all that can be known of all that exists is a vast and unified whole, theology is necessary to fill out what's missing in the other sciences and to prevent those sciences from assuming too much on their own behalf, as if medicine or economics or astronomy could fill theology's place. But now Newman returns to the first problem. What's the use of the work of a university? I suppose it shouldn't surprise you what his answer is. Knowledge is capable of being its own end, he says. This is the second great claim that Newman makes in the idea of a university. Indeed, he says, we are satisfying a direct need of our nature in its very acquisition. Knowledge is valuable for what its very presence in us does for us. So, understanding things on their own terms, knowing the relations between them, encompassing the whole as an integrated unity, this is the great good of education. Hence it is, says Newman, that this education is called liberal, the power of viewing many things at once as one whole, of referring them severally to their true place in the universal system, of understanding their respective values and determining their mutual dependence. To have even a portion of this illuminative reason and true philosophy is the highest state to which nature can aspire in the way of intellect. Such a good, such a transformation of the self. It's like health for the body. The great intrinsic good, the perfection of human intellectual powers, is the result of education. And it's beautiful to behold, a pearl formed within the inner folds of the soul, the perfection of the highest powers of the human person. Such a thing, says Newman, stands on its own pretensions, is independent of any sequel, expects no compliments, refuses to be informed, as it's called, by any end or absorbed into any art in order duly to present itself to our contemplation. In short, education of this sort might have its uses, but of itself it tends to enjoyment, to a kind of rejoicing in itself. How fair indeed is the one whose beauty shines forth. But then, says Newman, it's as real a mistake to burden liberal knowledge with virtue or religion as with the mechanical arts. What? We might say liberal learning, the highest form of education, the beautification of the mind. Perhaps it makes sense to us that such learning should not be considered a servant of the useful, as if one ought to perfect one's mind merely to increase one's salary. But likewise, says Newman, liberal learning does not have as its intrinsic purpose moral and spiritual perfection. Knowledge is one thing, says Newman. Virtue is another. Good sense is not conscience, refinement not humility, nor is largeness and justice of view faith. Liberal education, he says, makes not the Christian, not the Catholic, but, and I think I can say this with today's audience, the gentleman. Quarry the granite rock with razors, or moor the vessel with a thread of silk. Then may you hope with such keen and delicate instruments as human knowledge and human reason to contend against those giants, the passion and the pride of man. So there we have it. For Newman, perfecting your mind does not perfect your soul. A liberal education does not make you good, though it is nonetheless well worth pursuing. Like the health of the body, the health of the mind, its learning and wisdom, is not itself an indication of holiness of life. But even if liberal education is neither properly speaking professional training or school of virtue, it nevertheless has deep and lasting implications for one's professional life, and so also for one's spiritual life. One doesn't need to look very hard today to find those who'd criticize liberal learning as an expensive waste of time. How does one of the old jokes go? An engineer asks, "How does it work?" A scientist asks, "Why does it work?" And a liberal arts major asks, "Do you want fries with that?" The critique's actually an ancient one. Plato confronted it in his Republic, and Newman quotes the 17th century English philosopher John Locke in The Idea of a University. "Reason would advise," said Locke in his 1690 essay on education, "that parents should arrange it so that their children's time should be spent in acquiring what might be useful to them when they come to be men, rather than that their heads should be stuffed with a deal of trash," I'm still quoting Locke, "a great part whereof they usually never do, tis certainly never they never need to, think on again as long as they live. And so much of it as does stick by them, they're only the worse for." And Locke again, somewhat later, speaking of poetry, "I know not what reason a father can have to wish his son a poet. Who does not desire him to bid defiance to all other callings and business? Which is not yet the worst of the case, for if he proves a successful rhymer and gets once the reputation of a wit, I desire it to be considered what company and places he's likely to spend his time in, nay, and estate, too. For it's very seldom seen that anyone discovers mines of gold or silver in Parnassus. 'Tis a pleasant air, but a barren soil." Would you like fries with that indeed? Newman will have none of this. That which is useful, according to Newman, is not what is simply good, but also what tends to good, or is the instrument of good. Good is not only good, but reproductive of good. This is one of its attributes. Nothing is excellent, beautiful, perfect, desirable for its own sake, but it overflows, spreads the likeness of itself all around it. Good is prolific. So if liberal education be good, he says, it must necessarily be useful too. Liberal education doesn't fit us for law, or medicine, or engineering, or computer science. It isn't useful in that way because it doesn't impart the specialized knowledge needed to perform specialized tasks. Instead, the perfection of the mind, the cultivated intellect, because it's good in itself, brings with it a power and a grace to every work and occupation which it undertakes, and enables us to be more useful and to a greater number. Here's two examples. These are from Newman. "Speaking good sense in English makes all the difference in one's life," he says, "for conversation in all its forms is the medium of something more than an idle pleasure. As for its power and influence, we may fairly say that it's of just the same consequence to a man's immediate society how he talks as how he acts." So, liberal education makes one able to communicate, to commune, to share in the life of others in deep and transformative ways. The skill of communicating well, with the right word in the right place, to form one's thoughts persuasively, to share them eloquently, this is not a particular professional skill, though it's needed by every profession. And the one who can communicate well has built already the foundation of all professions. Here's the second example. Liberal education grants us good judgment. Judgment, here's Newman again, "judgment does not stand here for a certain homely, useful quality of the intellect that guards a person from committing mistakes to the injury of his fortunes or common reputation. It stands for that master principle of business, literature, and talent, which gives him strength in any subject he chooses to grapple with and enables him to seize the strong point in it, to see what matters, to see what's important. Liberal education teaches us," as he says, "to see things as they are, to go right to the point, to disentangle a skein of thought, to detect what's sophistical, to discard what's irrelevant. It prepares us, therefore, to fill any post with credit and to master any subject with facility. Newman might have said, to be honest, that the great task of education is to impart the powers needed to go on in life, to see what must be learned, and to know how to learn it, to make of one's entire life a kind of school, to be, in a trite but nonetheless strangely apt phrase, lifelong learners. So even if the true purpose of true education is not usefulness, such an education is deeply useful nonetheless. Just one story. I had a business student in Providence College told me recently, in all her internship interviews and post-graduation job interviews, all her interviewers wanted to talk about with her was her Catholic humanities minor. They weren't interested in accounting. They weren't interested in management, finance. I tend to tell people like her, I have no wish to dissuade them from being business majors, but complement your major with another major or minor in the humanities so that you will become an interesting person. Now, although it's also true that liberal education is not the same thing as moral or spiritual development, here too Newman sees deep connections. But now Newman makes us more uneasy. The educated mind, he says, may be said to be in a certain sense religious. That is, it has what may be considered a religion of its own, independent of Catholicism, partly cooperating with it, partly thwarting it, at once a defense, yet a disturbance to the church. Would it be not a wonder and a comfort if liberal education, that beautiful perfection of the human mind, could slide easily into its place as servant of our soul? But we know well that human goods are never like this. Our bodily health should serve us, but sometimes it merely makes possible worse wickedness than we would otherwise be capable of performing. So too intellectual perfection. Right reason, says Newman, that is, reason rightly exercised, leads the mind to the Catholic faith and plants it there and teaches it in all its religious speculations to act under its guidance. But reason considered as a real agent in the world and as an operative principle in man's nature, with an historical course and with definite results, is far from taking so straight and satisfactory a direction. It considers itself from first to last independent and supreme. It requires no external authority. It makes a religion for itself. Now, the cultivation of our minds does in some ways lead us away from vice. By refining the mind, it gives it an indisposition, simply natural, yet real, more than this, a disgust and abhorrence towards excesses and enormities of evil, which are often or ordinarily reached at length by those who are not careful from the first to set themselves against what's vicious and criminal. At Providence College, the humanities program I help run offers a course each semester called Beer. Its purpose is to be more thoughtful about alcohol, to refine the palate. Yes, there are tastings. You have to be 21 to take this class. To refine the palate, understand the proper place of drinking within a healthy and virtuous community. No doubt one thing this class might do is lead students away from binge drinking. Isn't it more enjoyable in the end to sip slowly and luxuriously than quickly and thoughtlessly? There's something right about this, argues Newman, though we have to be careful too. Doesn't our pursuit of the higher pleasures, refined and calculating as only education can make possible, it begins by repelling sensuality, he says, but it can end by excusing it. All the trouble is rooted in the nature of the perfection of the mind as a good in itself as beautiful and choice-worthy and a source of joy. The educated mind's private religion assembles its virtues and vices in light of its own admittedly impressive perfection and casts to one side any reference to a higher power who loves us, who chastises us, and whom we must serve. So proper religious fear, directed beyond ourselves, can become mere shame, embarrassment at our failures. Contrition, of which God is the object, can become remorse or regret. We are fools rather than sinners. Confession has no place, and instead we pursue with steady concentration and intense self-contemplation. A refined moral sense or taste replaces conscience in the true meaning of the word. We laugh over vice as ridiculous deformity rather than weep over it as supernatural wound. Humility is transformed into modesty, pride into self-respect. And yet, says Newman, in light of all these features of the religion of the mind, it's obvious to observe that there's no doctrine contained in them which is not in a certain sense true. Yet on the other hand, that almost every statement is perverted and made false, because it's not the whole truth. Just as true education must include and integrate all the sciences, lest one distort and itself suffer distortion, so each one of us must include and integrate all the perfections of life, lest one claim us for itself to the loss of all the rest. So concludes Newman. All the wonders of liberal education may subserve the education of a St. Francis de Sales or a Cardinal Pole. They may be the limits of the contemplation of a Shaftesbury or a Gibbon. Basil and Julian were fellow students at the schools of Athens, and one became the saint and doctor of the church, the other her scoffing and relentless foe. Where does this leave us? Even though liberal education is not in itself any guarantee of virtue or holiness, we can't discard it. Indeed, we need it for so many reasons, some of which we've been talking about this evening. Our health can make it easier for us to wreak havoc on the world, but we don't say for that reason that we shouldn't be healthy. Newman ends with a bold claim. A direct and active jurisdiction of the church over the Catholic university and in the Catholic university is necessary, lest it should become the rival of the church with the community at large. But he doesn't say much about what this might look like. Pope John Paul II thought carefully about this in Fides Ratio and Ex Corde Ecclesiae in the 1990s. But even there, one can at times feel uncertain of the best way forward. And yet, Newman does, in his final pages, offer us a kind of answer. He's searching, all of us are searching, for an integrated life, a whole life, a life that receives God's gifts with gratitude and joy, and that returns to him what is owed with generosity and love. This is what we might mean by holiness of life. And Newman, rather than propose principles and rules of action, instead offers an exemplary life to study and to imitate. The life of St. Philip Neri, the Apostle of Rome, he who ministered to the educated and the wealthy, artists, scholars, as well as the poor and the simple. This man of the Renaissance, writes Newman, he saw the high and the wise, the student and the artist, painting and poetry and sculpture and music and architecture. He preferred to yield to that stream and direct its current, which he could not stop, of science, literature, art, and fashion, and to sweeten and sanctify what God had made very good and man had spoilt. And so, continues Newman, he contemplated as the idea of his mission, not the propagation of the faith, not the exposition of doctrine, nor the catechetical schools. Whatever was exact and systematic pleased him not. He put from him monastic rule and authoritative speech, as David refused the armor of his king. No, he would be but an ordinary individual priest as others, and his weapons should be but unaffected humility and unpretending love. It's those who embrace the perfection of the mind and its works, and in their lives show us the subordination of those great goods to those still greater, who can by their example elevate the university education and university life into its proper and noble place. St. Philip Neri was such a one for St. John Henry Newman. How glad we ought to be that St. John Henry Newman is such a one for us. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this lecture on the Thomistic Institute podcast. The generosity of people like you makes this podcast possible. If you enjoy these talks, please consider showing your support at www.thomisticinstitute.org/donate. Your donation of even a dollar helps us reach more college students and many others with the powerful truths of the faith, and it ensures that we can keep publishing top-notch lectures on this podcast. Thanks a lot.